tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump predicts North Korea would be very rich, and he's promising the Kim family dynasty very adequate protection to stay in power if it agrees to give up its nuclear weapons. If leader Kim Jong-un does not agree to such a deal, however, Trump is warning the impoverished nation's faces being, quote, decimated.
But if we make a deal, I think Kim Jong-un is going to be very, very happy. I really believe he's going to be very happy.
Here's former U.S. Ambassador Christopher Hill.
I think the Trump administration has perhaps done a little too much talk in public about it and not enough preparation for the actual summit. And so as the president's been doing some victory laps, it seems to me he should have understood that he first has to run the race.
Trump says planning discussions continue between the U.S. and North Korean leaders, who are behaving like nothing happened despite statements from Pyongyang casting doubt on the summit. Two Syrian nationals have been indicted in a computer hacking scheme that targeted the White House, according to Harvard University, U.S. Marine Corps, and media outlets. A federal grand jury returned an indictment Thursday charging Ahmad Dar with conspiracy and aggravated identity theft. The indictment says the men were members of the Syrian Electronic Army, which hacked computers to spread propaganda supporting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Officials in Hawaii say there's been an explosive eruption. This is VOA. At the Kilauea Volcano Summit, sending a plume of ash more than 9,000 meters into the air early Thursday. Authorities have been warning residents and airplanes to stay away from parts of the Big Island. U.S. Geological Survey says the explosion came after 2 weeks of volcanic activity that sent lava flows into neighborhoods and destroyed at least 26 homes. President Trump is casting doubt on the prospect of successful trade talks with China, saying the economic powerhouse has become, quote, very spoiled because it usually gets its way with the U.S. Trump says the U.S. has been losing $500 billion a year on trade with China. And President Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, says the president could not be indicted over the Russia probe.
Attorney Rudy Giuliani says Robert Mueller has all the facts to make a decision after 12 months of investigating Russian interference and Trump associates. Giuliani, appearing on Fox News Channel, said Mueller should bring it to a close, saying that he's gotten 1.4 million documents and has interviewed 28 witnesses. And he has nothing, says Giuliani. The president's legal team has been weighing whether to allow Trump to sit for an interview with Mueller. So far, the special counsel's office has charged 19 people, including four Trump campaign advisors. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
The anticipation of legal sports gambling throughout the United States has prompted a flurry of deals among gambling and technology firms who want a foothold in a market worth billions. Casinos, racetracks, daily fantasy sports companies, and others are itching to offer bets in person and online after the Supreme Court ruled Monday that states could allow or begin allowing wagers, and that's led companies all over the world to seek ways to team up. The industry is preparing for most of the betting to happen on smartphones, just like in Europe. That would also be new for most U.S. states, as internet gambling has been limited to just three states. As Taiwan's president reaches the halfway mark in her first term Sunday, she's under growing pressure from a public tired of economic stagnation, but critical of her reform efforts. An increasingly aggressive Beijing is tightening the screws on Taiwan. I'm Lori London in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Friday, May 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. DRC's latest Ebola outbreak appears to be spreading to other cities.
It was not too bad when it remained in remote villages. Now, the fact that it reached one of the big cities of DRC, we have to really put in place the different measures to avoid to spread it.
Axel Ramsey is Emergency Coordinator for Doctors Without Borders. We'll examine the impact of a new Ebola vaccine. A spokesman says South Sudan President Salva Kiir did not accuse the police and the army of being criminals. Zambia said its Middle East policy is a two-state solution of a peaceful Israel and Palestine. And Sierra Leone's government has been sued in the ECOWAS court for banning pregnant girls from returning to school.
What's ultimately happened is that so many girls are now banned from attending school if they become pregnant, and the government has not been focusing on the causes of those pregnancies, a lot of which have to do with sexual violence or exploitation.
Krista Stewart is the End Sexual Violence Program Manager for the U.S.-based Equality Now and observing International Day Against Homophobia in Africa. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has spread to an urban area of more than 1 million people, the World Health Organization announced on Thursday. One positive case was confirmed in the port city of Mbandaka. So far, this outbreak has counted a total of 44 Ebola cases. Doctors Without Borders on the front lines and helping set up treatment centers. Emergency Coordinator Axel Ramsey spoke to Ricky Stryak about how reaching an urban center means this outbreak sounds a higher level of alarm.
It was not too bad when it remained in remote villages. Now the fact that it reached one of the big cities of DRC, we have to really to put in place the different measures to avoid to spread it. And then it means that we really have to go straight to treat them, isolate them, continue to follow the contact, doing a sensitization of the population, looking at the deaths and try to organize proper funeral. And we also have to look at all the other health structures that could admit patients to be sure that the preventive measures are in place for this.
I would guess, especially in regions like this in DRC that are already probably understaffed, the staff is probably overworked and undersupplied already as it is.
Right, yes.
And obviously, one of the concerns is always the healthcare workers and their safety.
This is one of the first. One of our first concerns is the health of the staff and the security of the staff. Because if you don't have a staff in good health, you cannot treat the other one. And then one of the first things that we bring is also material for the staff to be able to protect themselves, and also providing some training and to explain how to avoid the disease and to avoid to get the disease, to avoid to spread the disease.
DRC has a history of these outbreaks. This is the ninth in the country in 40 years. But most of those have been contained in remote areas, isolated areas. Is there any information so far about how this specific outbreak managed to reach a port city, a large urban area?
Then it seems that the initial cases are coming from this Bikoro area, and some of the contact of a patient who become sick were able to travel to this city, because just you have road, and it's, as you mentioned, it's a big city where people are traveling to. Then I guess for the moment, it's like they are still linked with the initial case that we had in the area of Bikoro, the ones that we have actually in Mbandaka, and it's just because they were traveling maybe to look for better care.
What is the role that vaccines and treatments will play in this outbreak in comparison to just last year's in Nkati, and how has this evolved from last year's cases, and also especially, of course, the 2014 outbreak?
This vaccine was used during the West Africa outbreak, and it showed some good results. And I guess this vaccination is now like an additional arm to help to fight this vaccine. This disease is not the only things that we have to do, because all the other things are still supposed to be done, like treat the patient, doing sensitization in the community, and so on. But I mean, vaccination is maybe an additional arm to try to avoid the spread.
Axel Runzer is the Emergency Coordinator for Doctors Without Borders. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Brussels. The World Health Organization reports that so far 44 cases of Ebola have been confirmed in the DRC and more than 20 people have died. VOA's Carol Pearson tells us the difference between the outbreak in Congo and the epidemic that swept through West Africa 4 years ago.
Even as Ebola spread to an urban area in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, said we now have better tools than ever before to combat Ebola. One of those tools is an experimental vaccine that has already arrived in the DRC. The vaccine was developed close to the end of a massive Ebola outbreak in West Africa between 2014 and 2016, and it proved to be safe and effective. Anna Maria Hanau Restrepo with the World Health Organization says WHO is confident the vaccine will be available throughout this outbreak.
Merck, the vaccine manufacturer, has reassured WHO that we have access to further doses of vaccine as necessary during the outbreak.
The DRC Health Ministry plans to start vaccinating health workers and others exposed to the virus in the next few days. Isolation units to treat the sick are already in place. And even though the outbreak started in the remote rural town of Bikoro, from the start, the WHO's Dr. Peter Salama said no one involved took anything for granted.
We are very concerned and we are planning for all scenarios, including the worst-case scenario.
The worst scenario would be for the virus to spread in heavily populated urban areas. Salama has called the discovery of the case in Madaka a game-changer. That city lies along the Congo River, a heavily traveled waterway that is 4,000 kilometers from Kinshasa, with a population of 10 million. Salama visited the DRC with Tedros on May 13. That pleased Stephen Morrison with the Center of Strategic and International Studies, who conducted research on the 2014 outbreak.
I thought it was very commendable and a great sign of the change of outlook that Dr. Tedros himself was personally there, and that was very important. It rallies the troops, it shows determination and commitment and speed.
The WHO has reorganized since the devastating outbreak in West Africa that killed more than 11,000 people. Morrison says it's evident in the organization's response, as well as in the response of the DRC.
The response to this outbreak has been quite different from the very delayed response over a six-month period in 2014 in the outbreak in West Africa. It's the ninth outbreak in Congo. This is a country that has a lot of experience in dealing with outbreaks of Ebola.
While the fear is that the outbreak could become an epidemic in major cities, as it did in West Africa, systems are already in place to try to ensure that it does not, even though the challenge is now tougher. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, May 18th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. Sierra Leone's government has been sued in the Community Court of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, for banning pregnant schoolgirls from returning to school after giving birth. The government imposed the ban in 2015 because it said then it wanted to protect innocent girls from negative influences. The U.S.-based Equality Now and the Gambia-based Institute for Human Rights and Development in Africa brought the case seeking to lift the ban. Crystal Stewart is the End Sexual Violence Program Manager for Equality Now. She says the ban is a form of discrimination that does not take into consideration the causes of the pregnancy, including sexual violence and exploitation.
What's ultimately happened is that so many girls are now banned from attending school if they become pregnant, and the government has not been focusing on the causes of those pregnancies, a lot of which have to do with sexual violence or exploitation. And we're launching the case to really vindicate their rights and to put the blame on the perpetrators rather than on the girls themselves, who are bearing the brunt of both the sexual violence and also now the lack of access to education, which is really going to have a harmful impact not only on those girls and their families, but the community at large.
Krista, as you probably know, some of these girls that we are talking about, maybe they get pregnant at very, very early ages. And if I do remember, the purpose for the Sierra Leone government instituting this policy was to protect what they call innocent girls from negative influences.
So that was one of the stated reasons, which is really, I think, a misconception on the situation of so many of these girls who are pregnant due to sexual violence or exploitive relationships. And just, you know, even under the law itself, girls under 18 aren't able to consent to those relationships. So it's not as if these girls have made a choice freely and of their own will. That, coupled with the lack of education around health rights and the role of health within schools, is really putting it in a problematic position, in that they're kind of blaming the girls themselves for something that's been done to them.
You know that, Krista, Sierra Leone now has a new government and a new president. Mm-hmm. The new president has instituted free primary and secondary education. Did you try first to talk to this new government before filing your lawsuit?
Yes, we've been trying for many years, and I believe that the efforts have continued. We've been trying to speak to the government for many, many years, and we are very encouraged by some of the initial statements that have been made by the administration about not only addressing education, which is critical, but also really looking at how the state can enforce their and bolster their ability to prosecute cases, and really importantly, kind of fund the structures that will allow further prosecutions and investigations. So we're really heartened. But again, there is a whole group of young women that have been not treated fairly in the past 4 years, and we're really trying to get reparation and sort of a new direction from this point forward.
So what do you want? I'm assuming you just want what? This policy to be lifted or what?
Right. So we absolutely foremost would like a declaration that the policy is unlawful and discriminatory and of course revoked. We'd really like the government, most of all, to take appropriate measures to really investigate and prosecute sexual offenses and sexual violence against girls. And then I think there are a whole range of things that can be done on the policy level in terms of making sure that those cases are followed through, and to also look at strategies, programs, and campaigns that can really get at the root of the problem of teenage pregnancy, and increase public education and awareness, as well as sort of bolstering education.
Krista Stewart is the End Sexual Violence Program Manager for the Equality Now. She was speaking with me from New York. The spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir has denied media reports that the president accused the police and the army of being criminals. Atain Wakatain says the president was reminding the police and the soldiers at a police conference in the capital Juba on Thursday to take their respective jobs seriously. The president was quoted as saying, "Shame on you. You are the custodians of the law. By daytime, they are soldiers, and by night, they are criminals." Critics say the president's pronouncement is an admission of his failure as the commander-in-chief of the army. But presidential spokesman Atain Wakatain tells viewers Peter Clotty that the media reports were misleading and that the president's statements were taken out of context.
The president was reminding the police in their fourth conference to observe and implement the law. Some police officers sometimes who come out to take law into their own hands. And the president was categorically, generally, in some places, there are a number of boss names that are not around, and they are taking public money, you know, without any legal ground.
I tell you, the president said that people are still being killed in their homes at night. He accused the police that by daytime they are soldiers and by night they are criminals. What does the president mean by this?
No, the president was talking about the security situation of Cuba, whereby they operate, you know, at will. And he wanted the police to pick up the role of protecting the city at night instead of sleeping or not doing enough to protect the people. And the president was not saying the police, the one looting people at night. This is not what the president has said. He said, you as a police, you have to do your role. As a police officer's job is to protect the civilian and their properties. If by negligent police officers becoming, you know, part of the organized crimes, he has it, the president was trying to say here, because there are a number of people who in that got robbed. And the armed robbers comes at night, with uniform. Sometimes they have soldier's uniform or, you know, the army uniform or the police uniform. And that comes down to the fact that the criminals are very, very serious. And they buy the police uniform or the army uniform in order to look like an army, portray themselves as if it is an army or the police that is looting the civilian. When in actual fact, the officers is true, the organized crime. Of anybody who wanted to be criminal.
But I tell you, the president has assured the whole world that Juba is peaceful, the country is peaceful following the conflict. So if the president on one hand is telling the international community and South Sudanese that peace has returned to South Sudan, yet he is excoriating these police and soldiers of committing such crimes or allowing some of these crimes to happen, then where is the truth?
So there is a difference between insecurity and organized crime. They are two different things. You can organize anywhere, in most Washington, D.C., in Chicago, in Brazil, in Rio. Cities have organized crime. What is important is the extent of how the police and the security organs deal with organized. I wanted to tell you. And the assurance given by the president on the basis that Juba is secure is true, because insecurity and an organized crime are not the same thing. There are crimes elsewhere which are organized by the criminal, not necessarily the rebellion. So what is happening in Juba has nothing to do with those who have taken arms against the government, but organized crime. And it has to be dealt with in according to the laws that are available in South Sudan.
Atain Wek Atain is the spokesman for South Sudan, President Salva Kiir. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the capital Juba. Zambia said its Middle East policy is a two-state solution of a peaceful Israel and Palestine living side by side. Zambia was among 86 countries, including 33 from Africa, that attended celebrations earlier this week to mark the U.S. Embassy's relocation from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Amos Chanda, spokesman for President Edgar Lungu, says Zambia continues to engage with both Israel and Palestine to make whatever contribution it can make that will guarantee lasting peace in the Middle East. But first, Chanda denies local news reports that President Lungu is building a mansion in Eswatini, formerly Swaziland.
There is no presidential mansion in Eswatini, Swaziland, whatsoever. What you are seeing, again, is the appalling standards of journalism in the country. The president traveled to Swaziland as a guest of honor at the Swazi Trade Fair. I also graced the occasion of the traditional reed dance ceremony. He was invited to attend the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Swazi nation, which is now Eswatini. So there's a relationship, a private relationship between these two heads of state that gets going. As a result of that, a symbolic gesture of friendship between the two resulted in the gift of a piece of land. I don't know if it's 4,000 square meters given to the president. And there's not been any development of that land. Title has not yet been processed. There is no mansion whatsoever. Not a single cent, not a single Zambian kwacha ongwe has been spent.
And you don't think that there's impropriety in this matter at all?
There's absolutely no impropriety. If they bring up the matter, where is the $3.9 million value coming from? How would you apportion the value before you even do the deal of quantities? There's no development taking place there. How would a land less than 3 acres cost $3.9 million?
Okay, Amos, look, I wanted to ask you, because when the U.S. Embassy was moved to Jerusalem, I thought I might have read an article suggesting that maybe your country or your ambassador was one of the African ambassadors in attendance, and also that there was jubilation. Zambians jubilated about the movement of the embassy. What's the relationship now? Where does your country stand on that?
It was an event like any other. Zambians watched the events on television. There was no jubilation. Zambia stands by United Nations agreed resolutions towards a peaceful Middle East, a two-nation, two-state solution of two countries living side by side in harmony. That is Zambia's position on the Middle East crisis, and as much as possible, Zambia continues to engage with both Israel and Palestine with a view to make whatever humble contribution it can towards a two-state solution that will guarantee a durable, lasting peace in the Middle East. There was no specific jubilation anywhere about that event. It's not a subject where Zambia holds a specific position.
Amos Chanda is spokesman for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with the latest FIFA ranking as World Cup-bound Carthage Eagles of Tunisia are currently ranked the best team in Africa but ranked 14th in the world. Senegal and Congo DR sits at the 28th and 38th position respectively, while Morocco are 42nd. The Egyptian national team have maintained their 46th position, same as Nigeria Super Eagles, who are 47th in the world, to wrap up the top six in Africa. In the meantime, Morocco coach Javier Renard has announced a provisional list of 23 players and three reserves that will make up the North African team who returned to the World Cup for the first time since 1998. Younes Belhanda, Hakim Ziyech and Mehdi Benatia are among the star names in Morocco's World Cup squad, but Sofiane Boufal of Southampton is left out. The team will begin their preparations in Rabat on the 24th of May before taking part in three warm-up matches prior to the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. Javier Renard's Atlas Lions will play Ukraine on the 31st of May and Slovakia on the 4th of June, both games in Geneva, Switzerland, before taking on Estonia in Tallinn on the 9th of June. Elsewhere, Senegal coach Aliou Cissé also announced his provisional squad on Thursday, with Liverpool star Sadio Mane and Napoli centre-back Kalidou Koulibaly heading the Lions of Teranga list. The West Africans are returning to the World Cup for the first time since 2002 when they made it to the quarterfinals. Cissé's team will prepare for the World Cup with two friendlies. They will first face Luxembourg on the 31st of May before playing a warm-up game against fellow World Cup-bound side Croatia on the 8th of June in Zagreb. CAF President Ahmed Ahmed was among the top dignitaries that witnessed the Nelson Mandela's centenary match between South Africa champions Mamelodi Sundowns against Spanish giant Barcelona, played on Wednesday night. The match, which Barcelona won 3-1, was to honor South Africa's former president Nelson Mandela, who would have turned 100 years this year. We're still with football news as Kenya's national team, the Harambee Stars, will play Swaziland and Equatorial Guinea in international friendly matches in readiness for the Crunch 2019 African Cup of Nations qualifier against Ghana set for September. The Harambee Stars will take on Swaziland on May 25th, while the contest against the Naslek National of Equatorial Guinea will be on May 28th. Both games will be played in Nairobi. And in women's football, Nigeria's women's senior football team, the Super Falcons, have commenced preparation for the 2018 African Women Cup of Nations qualifiers against the Gambia. The two-leg fixture will take place between the 4th to the 12th of June. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this May 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Button, Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, warring factions in South Sudan's civil war are scheduled to begin meeting in Ethiopia on Thursday, May 17th, in an effort to end the brutal conflict. Despite several agreements and ceasefires, the fighting continues. South Sudan in crisis. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey. Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.